There's nothing more terrifying than a vicious person at a buffet.
People have very strong opinions about pizza. And, you know, for some it's sex, for some it's crack, for some it's, like me, it's just baked fat.
I crave anyway, them until I actually sit down and have them. I think, why did I want this, you know, soggy, kind of creepy burger? I thought it was kind of stingy meat department. In fact, at one point, I thought maybe I was eating a finch.
Longtime listeners to KCUR Central Standard and The Walt Bodine Show know that voice. Charles Ferruzzo was a charismatic food critic and a sharp writer at The Pitch and the Johnson County Sun. He didn't take cheap shots, though, which bought him a lot of respect in the restaurant scene. News this week of Charles's death has us thinking back on how important he was to Kansas City. So we're rebroadcasting this portrait session with him from 2015. Here he is talking with Gina Kaufman.
Hi, Charles.
Hi, Gina. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Fine.
You've spent most of your journalism and broadcasting career on the other end of the interview. Is this weird for you to talk about yourself?
Yeah, because I think I'm really one of the most boring people I know.
I think you're wrong. I'm going to ask you a question I haven't asked in a while just to get us warmed up. Where have you eaten lately?
I'm writing a review. Actually, it's written for next week on, when I write a review, when I'm done writing it, I erase it from my memory banks completely.
I have that with shows.
Yeah, I bet. I did. Yeah, too. The new Morton's Grill on the Plaza.
How was it?
You know, some things are really, really good.
Did you have a good time at the restaurant?
Yeah, I did. You know, I don't think it's a restaurant that's really caught on yet. There weren't a lot of people there on any of my visits, and I was there three times. It's kind of a weird concept, you know. Morton's is really the actual Morton Steakhouse. excuse me, is an expensive chain, and this is sort of their new concept that's moderately priced. But to me, any restaurant that charges $12 for a bowl of chili is not moderately priced.
So is that what's weird about the concept?
Yeah. It's sort of, you know, neither fish nor fowl for a steakhouse.
Well, Charles, do you have to like everything to be a food critic? I feel like I would have a really hard time with your job because even though I like a lot of things, I'm not into like pork, for example. And, you know, that seems like it would be a problem if you're supposed to review all restaurants out there.
Well, I mean, I'm a pretty easygoing eater. I was a much fussier eater as a child, I think as most people are. And I became increasingly less fussy over the years. I think it really helped in college when I was starving.
Starving is an antidote for pickiness.
No, yeah. I mean, it's hard to be picky when you don't have any money and you're, you know, willing to eat just about anything.
In your time as a food critic, have you developed a philosophy about food and certain guidelines for what is or isn't quality cuisine? Or do you come to every meal with like a totally clean slate?
I come to every meal with a totally clean slate because I don't think it's fair. I think I should lay this card on the table right away is that I am not a foodie. You know, I'm not even quite sure what the definition of a foodie is. I have my own thoughts on that.
That's like one of those words that people who are into food see as a negative, but a lot of people see it as a positive.
Oh, yeah. I think it's, you know, and foodies know a lot about food. My criticism with people who call themselves foodie, and this is I'm painting this with a really broad brush, so forgive me, but I find that people who are really passionate about food in kind of a neophyte way, they tend to romanticize food and fetishize, you know, if that's the right word. They fetishize food and
worship at the temple of kale.
Yes, exactly. And I think the fact that I worked in restaurants for so many years made me maybe, I don't want to use the word cynical, but more of a realist. I mean, I can't romanticize food because I've had to make it in a restaurant. I've had to serve it in a restaurant. I've had to clean up vomit in a restaurant. And, you know, when you have that kind of reality check, it's hard to be romantic about, pancakes.
We're going to get into a lot of your restaurant experience very shortly, but I'm interested that food is something that you don't romanticize, but it does kind of inspire you. I mean, it seems like your relationship with food as a food writer is that it's as much a literary muse as an interest in its own right. Would you say that's correct?
I would say that's correct.
Talk about talk about what it is about food that inspires you as a writer.
That's a good question. I might need to mull that over for a second here. I think we should backtrack a minute, and I should point out that I did not intend ever to be a food writer.
How did it happen?
It happened purely freakishly, accidentally. I was working for the Sun newspapers in Johnson County. I was there for 16 years. And at one point, I can't remember if it was my editor or my publisher, one of the two handed me a freelance restaurant review that I don't even know who wrote it. To this day, I don't know who wrote it. And asked me to edit it. Well, it was so badly written and so inept. And obviously this person not only didn't have a clue about the restaurant business, which a lot of food writers don't, but they didn't really have a grasp of food. And some of my critics would say I don't either. But it was just such a bad review that it was easier for me to rewrite it than to edit it. And after I rewrote it, A, they didn't hire the freelancer, and B, suddenly on my plate, I was reviewing restaurants.
On your plate, haha.
Yeah, no pun intended, really. And I really wasn't that gung-ho about it, because at that time, I was also working in a
part-time. What restaurant were you working in?
Well, I think, you know, I was thinking about that this morning. During my, during my first 20 years in Kansas City, I worked in 7 different restaurants. At that time, I probably was working at Mama Stafidi's, which was an Italian restaurant at 40th and Main.
And so you were juggling that job and your job at the Sun newspapers. Right. Doing what?
I was the feature editor. So let's throw this on the table, too. As the feature editor, I was the movie reviewer, the theater reviewer, the book reviewer. I was wearing all the hats. In fact, at one point, I was thinking to myself, who cares about my opinion on all these things? The fact is, I was on staff. I was making a salary. Why hire a freelancer to do it when Charles is there to write it?
I want to talk to you about being a writer, because what has always impressed me about your writing, I mean, among other things, is that you are funny, but you can also, you can make a good meal as funny as a bad one, which is a real talent. Your humor does not rely on a target. It's much harder to be funny at nobody's expense.
It is. It really is. I mean, when you're funny at somebody's expense, and let's face it, I mean, I was talking about this last night with a couple of performers. Actors and actresses say that, you know, it's a lot more interesting, a lot more fun to play a villain than a nice person. And maybe in real life, it's more fun to be a mean person. But some of those targets, like to review a bad restaurant, and I've reviewed lots of them, it's almost too easy to take pot shots. I mean, it's too obvious. And then in other cases, as you know, there is the side of being a restaurant reviewer where, unlike being a theater reviewer, a movie reviewer, you're essentially a consumer reporter, too. I mean, you don't want people to go to a restaurant and waste money on a bad experience. So you kind of have to be brutally honest.
But you live in the same community as the people whose work you're reviewing, whereas a movie critic or book critic, say, might be relieved of that kind of.
Well, you know what the biggest difference between a theater critic and a movie critic and a restaurant critic is this. The play that you see on Friday will pretty much be, with maybe some differences and nuances, pretty much the same performance you see Friday or Saturday. A movie is the same no matter what day or night you see it. It is always the same. The movie that you see on Friday, if you see it again on Sunday, it's the same movie. Nothing changes. With a restaurant, and I know this from working in restaurants and from going to restaurants, the experience that you have in a restaurant at 7 o'clock on a Saturday night could be the exact opposite experience that the person at the next table is having. Even if you have the same server, everyone has vastly different experiences.
So that must be really hard to juggle. Is that why you make so many repeat visits and take so many companions?
Yes.
Yeah. Talk to me more about the role of dining companions in your reviews.
Well, I used to write about them a lot more. And then my editor felt, and I think he was right, that no one cares what they have to say, really. Although I found that they were providing some pretty interesting feedback. The thing is, dining companions are important because you have to talk about a certain number of meals, and one person can't go to a restaurant and order. You know, that's why I can't cite a lot of movies here as an example, but there was, do you remember the movie with Julia Roberts called My Best Friend's Wedding?
I remember that it exists, but okay. I didn't see it.
Well, I saw it, and it was interesting for me because Julia Roberts, who probably weighed about 13 pounds, was playing a restaurant reviewer, which I thought was interesting. And she was at a restaurant alone eating one meal. You cannot review a restaurant via one meal. It's just impossible.
Yeah, that seems irresponsible to say.
And not only that, but you know, the chef is gazing at her from the window of the kitchen, and I thought, you know, this is completely unrealistic. But people who are watching the movies are going to believe that.
Well, what else is unrealistic about that scenario?
Well, you know, ideally, restaurant reviewers are supposed to be anonymous.
Kind of hard in a smallish town.
Kind of hard in any town, actually, you know, and, you know, the legendary New York restaurant reviewer Mimi Sheraton supposedly wore costumes. I've always wanted to wear costumes, but there's no budget. There's no budget for me.
Oh, Charles, I would love to help you come up with the costumes.
You know, I used to say on the old Walt Bodine show that restaurant owners never knew who I was because I was always in drag. As, you know, that ugly fat Italian lady, you know, eating alone at the table.
What else is unrealistic about that, though? Anything else we need to sort of tease out as movie version of food critic versus reality?
That she was, you know, not only thin and beautifully dressed and ate, you know, like two bites. It was just impossible to believe. But you know, no one really cares about the reality of those situations. Restaurant dining companions, to get back to your original point. They do add, you know, I mean, they do add an interesting perspective because things that I think taste wonderful, you know, my friends who go to dinner with me will sometimes think awful, awful, awful.
And they're characters. I mean, they've got great lines. You tease out this dialogue.
I don't do that so much anymore, but yes, they do. Sometimes hilariously. So because a lot of my friends have restaurant experience. They've been there. They know what it's like.
Well, we're going to come back to food a lot over the course of this conversation, and you can join in. If you've had a wonderful or memorable meal thanks to Charles Ferruzza, now's your chance to call him up and chat about it with him. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. So, Charles, you grew up in Indiana, right?
Indianapolis, the capital city.
Tell me about your upbringing, your family. You've occasionally shared little tidbits about your mom and dad on this show and in your pitch columns, but I really don't know their stories.
My mom and dad, neither of them from Indianapolis. I shared this with you recently, actually, for a financial show. My dad was from a very, very poor Sicilian family in New York, and my mother was from sort of a well-off family from a small Indiana town. They were completely mismatched. And in every possible way. But, you know, in the 1950s, I think rebellious young men and women didn't think twice about, you know, marrying outside their social class or their religion or whatever. And sometimes that doesn't work. My mom and dad, you know, were married a long time, but my dad was a liquor salesman. So we went to restaurants a lot as children because for two reasons. One is my mother was a terrible cook. And as we started going to restaurants more and more so my father could kill two birds with one stone. You know,
As they say.
He could, you know, take his family to dinner and write it off and as a sales call and actually, you know, schmooze with the restaurant owner.
I'm sorry to be fixated on your mother being a horrible cook, but can you tell us in some more detail what was so terrible about her cooking?
Well, I think the most important thing to say is that she did not like cooking. It was not a natural gift for her. Not that she had many natural gifts, but she didn't like it. She didn't really want to do it. It was a chore and not a fun chore. I mean, she was not a creative cook, to put it mildly. And as she realized that my father would take us out to eat, she became a more horrible cook, you know, sort of as a ploy. And so we would go out to eat even more frequently.
So tell me more about this mismatched nature of your mom and dad.
Well, my dad was very volatile. He was, you know, a first-generation American. He had a wonderful sense of humor. He and I had a very difficult relationship. I was the oldest, and I rebelled against everything they wanted me to do.
What did they want you to do?
Well, go to school, for one, and not smoke and not, you know, be a rebel.
So outlandish.
I know it. Well, I think my parents, like some other parents, I think they liked the concept of being parents, but the reality they didn't care for so much.
What kinds of realities were not going over great?
I've always said that my father really enjoyed having children until we could talk. And then, you know, I talked back and, you know, I did things that, you know, infuriated him like every day. And, you know, I was not an especially good student and I was not an especially good Boy Scout. I mean, I tried to do everything they wanted me to do, but badly.
Well, what did you want to be when you grew up? Like, as a kid, what were your ideas about what the future Charles Ferruzzo would be doing?
I just wanted not to go to jail, actually. What did I wanted to be a writer early on. I was a big reader as a kid and a voracious reader, actually. And I knew early on I wanted to be a writer. I didn't quite know what I wanted to write. And when I went to journalism school for college, my father was furious because he had also gone to the same college and he had been a journalism major. And when he graduated, I think in 52 or 53, he had an interesting awareness right immediately, which is that journalists don't make any money, sort of like it is now. And which is why I was a waiter for so many years, in addition to being a writer. And so he went into the liquor business so he could, you know, make money. So when I decided to go to college, and I wrote for my, you know, college paper, my high school paper, my father told me before I started college that if I went to barber school, he would pay for my education, but if I went to college, he would not.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's quite a statement.
Yeah, and he was, you know, in essence, it was a really good deal because, as it turned out, he was killed when I was in college. So, you know, it was a good thing that I was, you know, making my own money because there suddenly wasn't any.
Well, okay, so that's a really serious thing. Your father was murdered when you were in college.
Right.
What happened?
It was, you know, I'm sort of fuzzy on all the details because I never really knew all the details. What I do know is that my father was making a call in the early morning, actually, on a liquor store in Indianapolis. And he was either held up or we don't know what actually transpired. But somehow he did not leave that liquor store alive. And he was shot.
How old were you?
19.
And how did you get that news?
Interestingly enough, I was in the office of the college newspaper, and I got a phone call from my mother. And at that point, they thought my father, because they had found him in the parking lot, had a heart attack. Anyway, and so they called, and I went home, because at that point, my youngest brother was only 9 years old, and my mother was at the hospital, and I needed to be home with the rest of the children. And I didn't know my father had been shot or killed until the policeman came to the house.
So this is like the kind of thing that would really dramatically change things in your life, I would think. What else changed at that time?
It was a horrible experience because my father was sort of this larger-than-life character, and he was very controlling. I mean, I say this in jest, but it's true. My father, I was not allowed to wear blue jeans as a teenager or even in college because my father's, because he was from a poor family, he thought that farm children wore blue jeans.
So it was important to him that you reflect like this, the
social values
that,
yeah, the values that he aspired to. And my father always wore beautiful, beautiful clothes. But, you know, he had very distinct feelings about things, and, you know, short hair, Boy Scouts, all of that stuff. And
And so without him sort of pulling all the strings, we all sort of spun out of control in different ways, me being the worst. But
do you mind sharing how you spun out of control?
Well, I'd already actually been spinning out of control in some ways. I started drinking alcohol when I was in high school. There was plenty of alcohol in our house because of my father's profession, lots of alcohol. And I was a very shy kid and very intimidated by high school. And I felt that everyone was speaking a language that I didn't know, or they had a handbook on how to, operate in life that I didn't understand.
Or be a teenager.
Yeah, and I was, a lousy teenager.
I think all teenagers might feel that about one another, but go on.
Yeah. Well, one day during a very stressful period in my teen life, I took a shot of whiskey before I went to school. This would probably be my sophomore year of high school. And I don't even know what possessed me to do it, but that shot of whiskey gave me a sense of comfort and confidence and bravado that I didn't normally have. And from that point onwards, I started having a drink before I went to school every day.
As a high schooler.
As a high schooler.
Oh, Charles.
So by the time I was in college, I was well on my way to alcoholism.
And so, yeah, and then you were saying that your father passing away as he did was...
I drank more.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a really intense story. And I don't want to in any way make light of it. The idea of food as something that a person might gravitate toward is really interesting to me because, I don't know, I guess I just kind of think of food as this like antithesis to death. And maybe that's overstating a case, or maybe you'll find that silly.
No. I should also say that because my mother was really, I can't really explain this in appropriate detail, but my mother was a really lousy cook. And so I started cooking as a little kid. I was kind of interested in it. I liked the fact that, with an egg and flour and various other ingredients, you could actually make a cake, which my mother was completely incapable of.
This is fascinating because Ruth Reichel, she kind of tells a similar story that her mother's difficulty in the kitchen is part of what inspired her early on with food.
It's funny. One year, I have one sister, and one year she got an easy bake oven, the old fashioned kind that you cooked something with a light bulb. And she got that for Christmas. And my sister was and still is completely uninterested in cooking. So I took the Easy Bake Oven and I started cooking with it. And not that you could cook that much with an Easy Bake Oven, but I did learn how to, fry an egg with it and make a cake. And the funny thing is, my sister, who now lives in Los Angeles, is an actress. Her deal with her husband is that he cooks. To this day, maybe there's a genetic component that she's just like my mother. She doesn't want to cook.
Charles, what your career in food started in restaurants. When did you start getting involved in restaurant work?
As a teenager, my dad was convinced, probably accurately, that I was on the road to juvenile delinquency. And I should also say that, I don't think my parents had a clue that I was drinking. I really don't. I was careful to, brush my teeth and chew mints and things like that. So I didn't, get in my father's car or get on the city bus to go downtown to school smelling like whiskey. I was at least that attuned. And I was not a good kid or a good student. And I hung out with the bad boys. They were so much more interesting than, those honors list kids.
And you would have hated me in high school.
I tended to pretty much hate anyone who was on the honor roll. And, my father kind of shoved me into restaurant work.
Tell me about the first restaurant where you worked. Give it the Charles treatment. We're talking stories and descriptions.
Well, there were several. Let's just say that I was fascinated immediately. By the restaurant community, because they were the kind of people who worked in restaurants, and I started out as a busboy, but they were the kind of people that my parents didn't have as friends and wouldn't.
You know, my mother was scandalized for years that I was a waiter for so long, because that was just, you know, the people who worked in restaurants in her book were not the kind of people one socialized with. And which says volumes about her snobbery. But I was intrigued. And I think the funny thing is, and I've got to stop using that, but my mom and dad thought that working in restaurants would give me a sense of discipline and diplomacy and all of that, all of which was true. But they thought I'd be sort of shielded from bad influences. And I should say that, you know, working in restaurants is how I was first introduced to drugs and all kinds of illicit behaviors. And I was into it.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross, and you're listening to a portrait session on KCUR's Central Standard with Gina Kaufman and Charles Ferruza, a longtime food critic on KCUR. He died this week at the age of 62. We'll be right back with more of Charles's story in a moment. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross, and this is KCUR's Central Standard. We're listening back to a portrait session with Charles Ferruza today in the light of his recent passing. In 2015, Charles spoke about his life story and relationship with Kansas City food with Gina Kaufman.
Charles, you have not been a native Kansas Cityan. You weren't born here. We talked about your upbringing in Indiana. When did you come to Kansas City?
Well, I've lived in Kansas City longer than I've lived any place else. I moved here 30 years ago. Soon to be 31. And I came to Kansas City because I had left Indianapolis with a friend. We moved to, Philadelphia. And then we moved to New York City, where I realized very, very quickly that there are some people who could really survive in New York City, and I was not one of them. And so I made a phone call one day from our rancid little apartment. And I had a friend who I had known in Indianapolis, and she and her husband were living in Kansas City, which I might add, I didn't even know where it was. You know, I think the farthest west I had been, at least driving, was St. Louis. And she said, you know, we live near the Art Institute, we have a third floor apartment. And I think I told her that, you know, I was so miserable in New York, I was going to throw myself off the Brooklyn Bridge or something to that effect, something high drama. And she said, get in your car and drive to Kansas City. So the next day I packed up, I got in my car, I headed west, and about halfway there I realized, I don't even know where Kansas City is.
So you were already driving?
Yeah. I'm on my way on 70 Highway, and I have no idea where I'm going.
Well, you were on the right highway.
That much I didn't have right.
So how did you, tell me about the arrival in Kansas City.
Well, my first surprise was how much Kansas City was like Indianapolis. They're very, very, very much alike, except there's, you know, in Indianapolis, there's no state line. But and it was a very easy to maneuver city for somebody who constantly gets lost like me. And I loved my friends that I was staying with. And I thought I would get a job as a waiter or a bartender. But 2 weeks after I got here, I got the job as a reporter at the Sun newspapers.
2 weeks, that's not bad.
No, it was, for me, shocking, because the reason I had left Indianapolis was I couldn't find another newspaper job.
For someone who didn't grow up here, your mastery of Kansas City history is astounding. I mean, at the Pitch, where we worked together, everyone thought of you as the resident historian, and not just having to do with restaurants. We're talking everything Kansas City.
Don't you think, though, Gina, that the people who are most interested about a city's history are people who are not from here?
Sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, Kansas City does have a very interesting history, and I was always fascinated by it. I mean, it's a kind of a weird town, which is why I like it so much. And I clicked with Kansas City right away. I don't know that they so much clicked with me, but I thought it was a lively city, certainly a lot more interesting than Indianapolis, and a lot less snobbish and kind of, you know, it had kind of a dark underbelly, and I liked that too.
What were the first steps you took as, like, into Kansas City history exploration? Do you remember the learning process?
That's a great question. I used to spend a lot of time,
I would stumble into a building. Let's just, you know, let's lay this on the table, that I was still drinking. And I would stumble into old downtown bars like The Ship, which I believe used to be on 11th Street. That was my favorite. And it was a great bar. It still exists in some fashion down in the Bottoms. But
yeah, they've moved a lot of the signage and things
right.
like that.
And the interior of the bar, which looks like an old ship. It looks like the set of Anything Goes, actually. And so I kind of wanted to know what the backstory was. So I started spending time down in the Missouri Valley Room at the library, going through the city directories. And if you want to know about this city, that is the most invaluable source.
I like that your drunken inquisitiveness was about the history of Kansas City.
Yeah. Well, first it started with Kansas City bars, but, you know, it moved on to other directions.
Charles, when did the drinking end?
The drinking ended in 1988.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So tell me more about what Kansas City was like when you arrived.
Well, let's see. It was the 80s. The Country Club Plaza was very, very different than it is now. And I was living on the Country Club Plaza. I moved into an old apartment building and by that point. And, it was interesting for me because I was living in Kansas City, Missouri, but working in the suburbs. I refused to move to Johnson County. And wisely, as it turned out. And I just thought it was a fascinating city with fascinating people, really fascinating. You know, Walt Bodine was one of the first people I met.
Tell us more about meeting him.
He had his then producer, who I think was Ginger Unshroff at the time, call me because they were going to do a show on. It wasn't a restaurant reviewer show because I don't even know that I was reviewing restaurants at that point. They were doing a show on waiters and waitresses, and. Ginger called me, and I think I'd met her in one of the restaurants where I was working. And so I was on with a panel of really, you know, kind of tough cookie waitresses, you know, the kind that you didn't want to tangle with. And from that point on, Walt sort of became like a father figure to me. He really did. I mean, I would call him about everything.
And for people who, you know, maybe weren't in Kansas City when that show aired, that Walt Bodine was a broadcaster who was on this station
for a long, long time. And, you know, it's funny. At that point, he was still mobile. You know, he was still walking, although he had lost his sight. But maybe, you know, thinking about it, he really inspired a lot of my interest in Kansas City history because he knew so much about it. You know, he knew where. I want to say he knew where all the bodies were buried, that too. But he knew how Kansas City had progressed from the 30s on because he had grown up at Armour and Troost when Armour and Troost was a very, very different kind of neighborhood than it is now.
Well, what kind of change have you witnessed in Kansas City since you arrived?
Kansas City, well, when I arrived, there was still a gigantic shift to the suburbs. You know, when someone had a child, they immediately moved across the state line. I think that is still happening in a big way, although there's a lot more suburbs now than there were when I moved here. I mean, Lee's Summit was just a little dinky town. Kansas City, you know, is growing. And I think it's growing in the right way.
So, Charles, I guess, you know, what makes this place home to you?
Well, one of the first things I loved about Kansas City was the cost of living compared to the two cities I had come from, Philadelphia and New York City. The cost of living was so cheap here, and that was certainly a wonderful thing, that you could survive here with very little money and still kind of have a life.
Tell us about the life you had. I mean, it sounds like you have some experience with that.
Well, I mean, when I moved here, even though I didn't have a lot of money, I could actually eat out in restaurants. This is, you know, even before I started working in them here. And I used to eat at Pooch's Cafeteria 3 nights a week, which now that I think about it in retrospect was weird. But I could afford to eat in restaurants. And I was working so many hours, I liked that. And when I started working in restaurants, that's how I actually started making friends. You do that when you work in restaurants. And until then, I really felt alone and isolated. And when I started making friends through the restaurant business,
that really changed my perceptions of Kansas City. That's when it started feeling like home.
That was Charles Ferruzza speaking with Gina Kaufman back in 2015. We'll be right back with more of Charles and Gina's conversation. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. You're listening to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. We're re-airing a portrait session today to remember the late Charles Ferruzza, a longtime food critic for KCUR. Here's more from that 2015 interview with Gina Kaufman.
Charles, hello again.
Hello, Gina.
Charles, we've talked some about your experience in restaurants, and you said you were working at like 7 different restaurants in Kansas City early on. And some of these places, like I happen to know that you worked for a while at the Athena.
On and off for a long time. I would get fired, and then the owner would call and hire me back.
Why did you get fired?
Oh, the stories are just too endless. I think one of the reasons is the owner, who was a very charismatic but kind of, you know, off-the-wall person, he liked to fire me.
And why did you get hired? Why did you get hired back after to be fired again for the thrill of firing you?
Well, the first time I worked there, which was 1985, he fired me every single Friday night. And then, but I was expected to be back at work on Saturday. I don't know. It was, you know, I think he liked to see me cry. He and my father.
You did cry, even though this happened routinely?
Yeah, it was a very emotionally stressful. Now, it's funny because I think I went back for the last round in 1990 and stayed there for 4 years.
And what restaurant is this?
This is the Athena, which was at 3535 Broadway. I loved working there. It was a great restaurant, wonderful food. Wonderful.
And it was a scene.
It was a scene.
Tell us about the scene.
Well, it was kind of a restaurant / art gallery. A lot of artists ate there. It very much had its regulars who, you know, I think miss it to this day. You know, you would see the same people there every Friday and Saturday night. And the food was good. And I loved the serving staff there. It was pretty easy. And when I went back, by this point, I had been on the radio for a while and at KCUR. And I think he felt I had some celebrity cachet to bring to the business. Ha ha. But, you know, because my theory is that journalists have about the same celebrity cachet as serial killers. but he had a new whipping person, a whipping boy to torment. So I was kind of off the hook then.
Congratulations.
It was merciful.
Were there any other of these places where you worked that had, I don't know, some sort of significance in the Kansas City that existed at that time that bring that moment of our city into life?
Well, I went to work at Mama's Tafiti's in 1986, and at 40th and Main, I think it's now a check cashing place. And it was very much a scene in the mid-80s. I mean, a real scene. And
what do you mean by that?
Well, it was like a hip happening restaurant in a neighborhood that probably had never had a hip and happening restaurant. And it was very highly stylized inside, very attractive. And it was a groovy kind of Italian restaurant, to use that word, which I still love, in the sense that—
Own it.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't serve Roma bread, which I love, I should say. Instead, they had fried breadsticks, which people loved. I thought they were awful. And it was just, you know, it was not like any other Italian restaurant in the city.
Do you think that might be where your comfort not having the same opinion as the crowd about food comes from? Like, you're so comfortable recognizing that your opinion veers from what everyone's saying. And I think what everyone's saying tends to influence a lot of us and affect how we perceive that food, that meal.
You know, I think anyone who calls themselves a critic should have discriminating taste. And discriminating doesn't always mean good taste. They should just have, you know, a sense of taste. And I am just as discriminating as about food or plays or books or anything else as I am about my friends. For example, I don't want to have a friend that likes everybody. I want a friend that doesn't like anybody but likes me.
You want to be the exception.
I want to be the exception to the rule.
And you want your restaurants to be the exceptions as well?
If possible.
So what's the rule if a restaurant's going to be the exception to it?
Ideally, it has to kind of stand apart from the rest, you know, other restaurants. I mean, you know, they're you know, chain restaurants, a lot of people really put them down. I've been known to do that. But, you know, chain restaurants do, which essentially, you know, the chain restaurant concept started in Kansas City between, you know, the Fred Harvey restaurants and Gilbert Robinson.
The Fred Harvey, that's the train stops on
the Train Depot restaurants. But they Fred Harvey's real genius was to make everything consistent, which Americans have come to love. They prefer their restaurants to be consistent, which mom and pop restaurants usually aren't. And, you know, say what you want about McDonald's, and there's a lot to say, but the, going to a movie or going to a play, the hamburger that you get on Wednesday is exactly the same hamburger you're going to get on Thursday. And until, you know, that kind of consistency became a norm in America, restaurants were wildly inconsistent and sometimes dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, this would be maybe an era before the transport of food
right.
was necessarily refrigerated.
Or really modern refrigeration.
Yeah. Well, so Charles, you cook, and I know you bake because I've eaten your lemon cake, but I want to be able to picture you in the kitchen. For example, me, I am a despot, and I go off recipe a lot, and it looks like a disaster has happened when I leave a kitchen. What's the vibe in the kitchen when you're
when
at
I'm
work?
Cooking?
Yeah.
I got to tell you that I usually have the radio on, 2KCUR, and Gina, at one point in my career at the Sun newspapers, in addition to everything else I was doing, I was putting out our weekly food section, which meant I tested recipes that I would run in the paper. And at that time, I was living in a very small apartment, and I had one of those little, what they call a railroad kitchen. I mean, it was just, you know, a sink, a refrigerator, and a tiny little stove. And I was actually making things and testing recipes in this tiny, awful, claustrophobic kitchen.
And no window, I'm guessing.
There was barely a light switch that worked. And I remember thinking at the time, this is going to totally ruin my, you know, interest and delight in cooking. And it almost did. But I have a nice kitchen now, not modern. It looks like a 1930s kitchen. I tend to go off recipe too a lot. And I think you have to know how to cook the basics before you can do that. I go into kind of a zen place, you know?
What is your favorite thing to cook?
I like to cook pasta for me. I have said this on your show before, that when I'm not having to go out to a restaurant, my favorite thing to make myself at home is a grilled cheese sandwich.
Oh.
That says volumes about
nice.
My culinary abilities. But
you also do have interests besides food. What are some of the other things you have an affinity for?
Reading, gardening, now that I have a garden. I have dogs now, which I never thought I would have. And sometimes I cook for them. A lot of times I cook. I think probably these days I cook more for my dogs than I do.
You cook for your dogs?
Yes.
Okay. Because, say more.
Canned dog food is kind of expensive, A, and my dogs don't like it. They will just, you know, they're worse critics than I am.
You have dogs who are picky about food. Dogs
horrible.
Are, like, notoriously unpicky. I mean, Charles, like,
my
you can't have a dog buffet because they would eat all of it.
Not my dogs, no. They prefer baked chicken, and sometimes I will find a very inexpensive cut of beef, and I'll cook that up. And, you know, they love mashed potatoes. They're probably not good for them, but, you know, we all have them.
And you can tell how they're reviewing these foods?
Oh, absolutely. You know, dogs are very communicative. I mean, I think sometimes they give more profound reviews than I do.
Charles, working as a food critic is something that a lot of people probably think is all fun all the time. What are some of the challenges of what you do?
One of them is, as I spoke of earlier, that everyone has a very, very different restaurant experience, even though you could be sitting, you know, two tables away. You know, people come in with a lot of preconceptions that they don't come in with when they're going to see a play or a movie. Also, you know, they're not easy to write. You know, there isn't really to me, an effective template for writing a restaurant review. And if you don't kind of get them cooked by your opening lead, then they're okay. Here's one of the reasons that the pitch does not use a star system, you know, where you give stars or
right.
For the ambiance or the service or the food, is that readers, and you know, I've been guilty of this, readers are lazy, so they'll only read the stars and not really read the review. And the art is to lure them in from the first paragraph onwards. And if you can't do that, you know, no one's going to read the review, really.
What does a review offer that the stars wouldn't?
A more nuanced and interesting, you know, the stars are, for one thing, they're skewed anyway. I don't believe in that star system, because how can you give the same or how can you use stars to the same kind of star system to review the American restaurant or, you know,
Town Topic.
Yeah, you can't. Although in their own, each restaurant has its own merits.
You do have sort of an egalitarian view of the field of restaurants, and not that you're not discriminating, because we've already clarified that you definitely are, but like you would approach a Greasy Spoon without any different kind of judgment as you, than you would respond to like the snazzy new restaurant everyone's buzzing about.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's interesting because I've been criticized a lot for that. And I think that if you, as a writer, and a writer uses words the way a painter uses a palette of colors, if you don't approach it with all senses open and without, you really have to leave your perceptions at the door, then you're doing everybody an injustice, the restaurant, the servers, and the reader.
What is it that like a really great Greasy Spoon would strive for in your mind? Like, what is greatness in that kind of a restaurant scenario?
Well, a Greasy Spoon is a Greasy Spoon, but you know, if they have one, if they actually make some of their dishes from scratch, that sort of elevates them into a more rarefied place, because it's so hard to find, you know, restaurants, going back to chain restaurants, where they're just not opening a bag or opening a can. I love restaurants where they actually make things from scratch. That they're so hard to find. They're almost like rare jewels.
Charles, is there like a restaurant experience that you've had as a critic that is just hilarious and that people should know the backstory on and join you for that experience?
Many, actually. One was, and it's archived on the Pitch website, you can find it, was for a restaurant that is unsurprisingly now closed. It was a chain restaurant in, I want to say, Olathe, called The Machine Shed. And I went there 3 times. And on all 3 visits, everything that could possibly go wrong went wrong.
For example?
Well, the server disappeared. She brought our food and we never saw her again. And then... just totally by accident, my friend Bob and I happened to be looking over, and somebody knocked into a screen, you know, one of those 3-panel screens, and knocked it over, and there was the waitress eating food out of the bus tubs. And I thought, you know what? You know, this says volumes about her service, how they're treated here, and maybe the quality of food.
Do you have other aspirations as a writer, or as being the novelist of Kansas City food writers, which is how I think of you, your truest calling? Is that your truest calling, or is there something else you're dying to do?
I would like to write it. I don't know if I want to write a novel. I don't know that I really have that talent. But I would like to write a book. I would like to write the Gina Kaufman story.
Uh-oh.
Or maybe the Charles Spurs
story. I've said too much in that case.
I don't know. I don't know what my next chapter is going to be. I mean, in my own evolution. I hope it's good.
Charles Ferruzza was one of a kind. We're going to miss him. The longtime food critic died on Tuesday. He spoke with Central Standard host Gina Kaufman for this portrait session back in 2015. You can read more about Charles at kcur.org and stay tuned for our next food show when we'll invite the critics, chefs, others who knew Charles, and all our listeners to remember our friend. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Up to Date is next.